Become a member of the Movie Geeks United family. Join us on Twitter at twitter.com/moviegeeksunite, Facebook at facebook.com/moviegeeksunited, subscribe to us through iTunes, subscribe to our YouTube channel at youtube.com/moviegeeksunited. You can also access our entire archive of content, including over 700 filmmaker interviews, at blogtalkradio.com/moviegeeksunited or at our official website at moviegeeksunited.net. Thank you for tuning in to this episode of the Movie Geeks United Art of Cinematography series. Tonight, we speak with Giles Nutchkins. Mr. Nutchkins worked on many high-profile projects early on in his career, including the Young Indiana Jones Chronicles for television and George Lucas's Star Wars Episode 1 and 2. Mr. Nutchkins capitalized on those tremendous early successes with terrific cinematography work in films like Young Adam, The Deep End, B-Season, the gorgeously lush Loss of a Teardrop Diamond, and this year's drama What Maisie Knew, a searing film about divorce that's told entirely from the perspective of a young girl. Mr. Nutchkins has already completed production on his next film, titled Don Hemingway, which features a tour de force lead performance from Jude Law.
I was 10 years old, and I managed to see a documentary shoot going on that was being done by the BBC. And I just remember, the cameraman being held over the top of an aqueduct by his assistant, and he had a 16BL on his shoulder. It seemed to me something that would be a really quiet and interesting occupation. And so I sort of asked about, you know, about what that was and what they were doing, and somehow about the idea of a man being connected to a camera at the age of 10 for a kid, it sort of seemed a bit like being a fireman or a policeman. It seemed like something exotic, something exciting. And I, you know, obviously at the age of 10, I hadn't really factored in the visual side of what we do. But then it was something that just stuck in my head. And so by the time I'd finished school, it was really firmly implanted in my head that I wanted to at least try to do something that was connected with film cameras.
Did you always feel the connection to or a desire to be a storyteller?
You know, these things sort of develop, and as I say, as a kid, you're sort of instantly attracted by one idea. My father gave me an old Kodak Retinette 2B, and that's when I started to take pictures. And at that point, it was a sort of technical, game of being able to, you know, place your focus, because obviously you couldn't see through focus, and guess exposure. So it was sort of the first time that I actually had to use my brain for myself to actually create something. And the beauty of a black and white image coming back out that you then went into a dark room and developed, it was certainly my first creative process as a child. And I know that meant something. It meant enough to me at the time to be interested in the mechanics of the process as well as what you are actually creating. The jump in terms of being a storyteller is a much later thing, but it happened very, very soon as I started getting involved in filmmaking directly.
Yeah. Were there mentors that taught you a lot? And if so, what were the most important lessons they gave you early on?
Well, I think you know, to explain sort of rapidly how I got into the business was that I then applied to the BBC, the British Broadcasting Corporation, because they had They had film crews, and then they had video crews. Video crews did obviously all the studio stuff and outside broadcasts, all the sports things. The film crews tended to do single camera dramas, you know, which were single camera like TV series, and obviously documentaries. And so the first thing I did was when I got into the BBC, I actually got in a different grade. I actually went into the electronic side. But I used to go around at the weekends and talk to the film people there, and they used to send me out with the news crews. And the news crews were shooting, they were actually shooting on 16BL, and they were shooting Stripe. So the cameraman was on his own doing a news item, and effectively the sound, the magnetic track, even though there was a sound mixer there, the sound was going straight down onto the same piece of film, because the Stripe went down the side of the piece of film. What that meant was that the cameraman himself was having to think about sound, think about image, think about creating a narrative, and thinking about creating a narrative at high speed that was going to be able to cut together very, very rapidly before to go out as a news item later on that day. In fact, they actually shot their images in order so that you wouldn't be breaking up the second track so much. And I, you know, and that was like, so suddenly my first access to film, and I remember being given a Canon Scoopic on the first day that I went out and did that to actually shoot it was the release of an oil platform. And the idea that there was this one guy that was having to basically create a story in his head that was going to be transmitted to probably not a huge audience, but hundreds of thousands of people, you know, a few hours later, seemed to me an all-encompassing process. It seemed to me that that was a fantastic thing to be able to do. One, to have a visual impact on people, but also actually to create that story. And I think that's the first point that I thought about narrative filmmaking, even though it was in a documentary form.
Mm-hmm. And a lot of that process, too, is kind of distinguished by the working fast and the speed in which you have to get it done. Do you work at that pace in some of the smaller independent films that you do? Is that part of the challenge?
Yeah, I mean, I think the initial interest about that was, you know, I mean, every person has this idea that they're going to be able to react to a situation in front of them and be able to react correctly, you know, whether that's somebody putting out a fire, or whether it's a dangerous situation or an accident or something like that. And I think in a filmmaking idea, certainly for somebody quite young, the idea that you're approaching a situation, you're taking in all of that information through your own observation, translating it into something else, which is a visual medium, and actually passing that on to something to some other people, I think is a great thing. And you're right, there's something about the speed of that process that is extremely exciting and also extremely satisfying and stimulating. So that, and the great thing about documentaries, I did documentaries for close to 10 years, was that you had, everything was there in front of you, you know, but you just had to synthesize all of that information very, very rapidly to know what you're going to be able to know the type of film or the type of documentary that you're going to get out at the end. And I think you're sort of right that process of actually taking in all of the factors relative to a narrative at the beginning of a day and being able to react correctly and rapidly to it is something that kicks me as a DP. You know, and I always say that when I'm working on a set is, and when you talk about mentors as well, I regard my mentor as Rick McCallum, with whom I worked obviously when he was working with Lucas and a bit before. I actually met him when I was a focus puller. And you know, one of those things was that Rick had this thing, is that you make all of your errors for the day are made within the first 20 minutes of call. And I think he's right on a practical level, in the sense that if you don't get going within those first 20 minutes, you'll be fighting at the end of the day. But I thought it's also correct both on a creative level, but also on a technical level for a DP. You know, a DP walks onto a set, particularly on exterior days, and they know they're going to get caught out at the end of the day. Mm-hmm. And unless you're thinking that far ahead, unless you're thinking about the amount of material you've got to get in the can, the amount of story that you have to tell before the end of the day, unless you put that into the process and you're working towards that, it's actually very difficult to find the starting point. And so it's sort of, occasionally I come across people who, you know, sort of they turn up, not so much DPs, because most of us at a certain level are actually, you know, we're all good at what we do, otherwise we wouldn't be there. But there are people in other levels of filmmaking that actually aren't aware that that pressure's on at that first moment. And I think that ability, if you like, the ability of DPs to be able to see the potential disaster at the end of the day, or, if you like, the potential lack of complete narrative that there will be at the end of the day unless they approach it in a certain way, is something that is exciting. I mean, that is an exciting thing. That is a challenge to me as a DP every single day, is to be thinking about how everything else will work out, you know, both in terms of telling a story, finishing the day, which, as you know, is very, very important in low-budget filmmaking, but also in way, just in very practical terms, in terms of lighting. When you start lighting, if you start lighting the corner of the room, you might have a beautiful corner of the room, but what happens when you expand to the rest of the room? These things are they're locked in our normal process of making films, and they're super stimulating, they're super demanding, but they actually makes you into a good DP.
You obviously worked on as you said, the Star Wars films pretty early on. How did that happen, and what was that experience like being in that environment?
Well, it happened because, as I say, you know, Rick effectively became my mentor. What happened was that, and I think this happens in everybody's filmmaking career. You know, I remember on one of your interviews, Bob Richardson talking about when he met Oliver Stone on Salvador. You know, that those are things that trigger off the next part of your career. And, you know, once you take a path one way, it's very difficult. You don't know the path you've left behind. And what happened for me was that I worked in the BBC, and I worked as a focus puller for a DP called Andrew Dunn, who you must know.
Mm-hmm.
And when Andrew left the BBC, I actually got his job as a documentary cameraman. And a short while later, he phoned me up and he said, come and focus pull for me. We'd been a picture. We'd worked on 16mm together mainly. He said, I've got a picture that's on 35. Dennis Potter is directing. Dennis Potter was the writer of Track 29 and The Scene Detective.
Yeah.
And was being produced by Rick McCallum. He said, come along. It's like the first feature film that the BBC at that time was doing. It was due for release and due to make into a TV series. It was the first time that the BBC branched out before BBC Films was formed. So that was a big sort of change in terms of filmmaking within the British TV industry. So yeah. Andrew, as a freelance, went back and did that, and I joined him on that, and that's where I met Rick McCallum. And then a couple of years later, Rick phoned me up and said, look, I've got this TV series, we're going to shoot it on 16mm, but it's for George Lucas, it's called Young Indiana Jones. And obviously, I was pretty interested. By that time, I'd done two very small independent features in India. And so I'd sort of established myself as a features DP at that point. And Rick said, come along and do that. So I did bits, certain episodes of the first series, bits of the second series, and then David did the first half of the third seasons, and then the season, and I did the last half of it. So that I was introduced at that point to Lucas and to Lucasfilm, and to a very, in a way, it was an interesting project, because all of us had come from TV. We'd all come from an idea that we were somewhere a long way from Hollywood, that we were, if not second-rate filmmakers, because I think there were some very, very good people working there, we were working 16mm, which was seen as a smaller format. And so suddenly to be working with Lucasfilm, the producer's George Lucas, Rick's extremely strong about what he does, with some interesting actors traveling all over the world, 16 and 35 mixed a lot of the time, that was a sort of big deal for me. It was a big break. I mean, I was only 30 as a DP, and it showed to me that there were possibilities of stretching out further than the world that I'd grown up in. And I think, you know, Rick's mentoring meant a lot to me. It meant a lot to me, one, because he sort of took David Tassel and myself to the side and sort of said, you know, we're going to knock all the bullshit out of you. You know, we're going to make you into real film cameramen, you know, people that are just pushing ahead, and that any of this, you know, the sort of the pretension that goes with the post will not exist at the end of our time together. And I think, you know, by the end of Star Wars, that was definitely true. He'd knocked it right out of us, you know, even if I'm sure both David and I were never particularly that way inclined anyway, but if it had ever come up, Rick would Brit would sit on it pretty rapidly. But what it did mean for me, it meant that, one, I had somebody that I regarded as a mentor and a friend, somebody in the wilder world of big filmmaking. You know, the fact that I could sit and talk to George about things seemed quite amazing to me. I mean, it was just so far from where I'd started, and that opened up possibilities. Basically, all of the limitations that I'd built on myself coming from, you know, working with the BBC in the west of England, those things didn't exist anymore.
Yeah, it must have been such an adjustment, because coming from the indie world, and now you're in the midst of this gigantic machine, I would think it might be easy to get lost in there.
Anybody that goes into that world, the idea that you have a limitation, the only limitation is yourself. And anybody else that puts limitations on you is somebody that's, you know, they're only facing up to their own evils. And I remember when I was in the BBC making some quip about, you know, ending up in Hollywood. And quite frankly, everybody just put me down. You know, everybody laughed at me like it was an impossibility for us to make that jump. And then the truth is that lots of people did make that jump. You know, you've got that determination, if you've got enough talent, and if you've got enough, basically enough energy, those possibilities will come. You know, they will come during your lifetime. I remember reading a thing where David Mamet said that, you know, everybody that goes to Hollywood, if you spend 20 years in Hollywood, you will get your chance. You might not recognize it, you might not use it, but you will get your chance. And I think that's a sort of solid thing to remember, that if you're a person of, you know, a capable technician, you know, who has some creativity, of reasonable intelligence, then the chances are that if you stick to it doggedly, you'll get your chance. It doesn't mean you're going to get an Oscar, but you're going to be able to play with some very interesting people in some very interesting places.
Absolutely. I mean, the ones that, you know, quote-unquote made it are the ones that stayed. That's the secret, if there is one, is not to give up. I don't want to ask anything too sensitive, but this interests me, because one of your early credits is obviously it's Battlefield Earth. that has gained a certain level of infamy, and we know what that kind of infamy, what that means to somebody like Travolta. But how did you absorb the failure of that movie?
Yeah, I mean, I think that's, you know, it's a really good thing for your viewers to your listeners to actually think about that, because as I say, everybody has a different career path. You know, you hit it lucky. I mean, I remember people talking in the BBC about how lucky Andrew Dunn had been, because he'd met Mick Jackson, who then did The Bodyguard, and he'd met some sort of great directors in there, Richard Eyre, who was the head of the National Theatre at the time. And those people gave him access to a world that let him come over to Hollywood and make some great films. You know, and then he worked with Bob Altman for years. Mm-hmm. So he's had a great career, and he's still working all the time. And some of it's sort of the luck of the devil, and, you know, it's the hand you're thrown. And it's a bit about how you deal with that. And to be honest, for years after that picture, after Battlefield Earth flopped, you know, and really, really flopped, nobody said, you know, it's the next Waterworld, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, then there were certain doors that become closed to you. And it's one thing about the system. One thing is about who you are, being a DP, the type of work you produce, and then the other thing is the projects you have been connected to. And I still get people saying, like, how, you know, why did you do that? You know, how could you make a decision like that to do a film that was regarded as such a terrible film, you know, an infamous film? And the truth is that I'd finished Star Wars doing second unit and then doing pickup work with George Lucas, main unit pickup work with George Lucas. And the director that did the second unit on Phantom Menace was looking out, and he then had the possibility of doing big pictures. And he came to me a short while later and basically said to me, I've got a picture, it's $60 million. It's got John Travolta and Forest Whitaker. It's sci-fi. And at that level, you know, I was mid-30s. So I'm at mid-30s. Somebody's offering me a big picture with stars that I recognize. You know, Forest, I think, has got an Oscar. John is John, who John is. It was like working with the big stars. You can't, it's one of those things you think, I've made it. And the script came to me, and and nobody would believe me about this, but the script sort of, it felt like a black comedy. It was sort of funny. It was written by a Scientologist, as we all know, but actually, I don't care the religion of the person that wrote the script. I'm actually just looking at the script. And it was, yeah, it was pulp, but it was pulp like Battlestar Galactica or Star Trek or anything else. And I think if it had the same production values, then it would have had a chance of survival. But the point about it is that you get caught into things that, you know, I mean, I still think at 35 is a fairly young age for a DP, but the attraction of that, of entering into that big budget world, is extremely great. And so when it came my way, I remember my agent saying, I don't really, really want you to do this. She actually wants to put me up for Quills. And you know, this thing was an offer on the table. It was a straight offer on the table. And to actually turn around and turn a thing like that down would have almost been impossible. I also think in some ways it would have been an odd thing to do. It would have been a very, very strange thing to be offered a $6 million picture at that age and to turn it down. And so you go ahead with the best of intentions and with whatever experience you have to try and make it look the best you can. There's no doubt that the industry does judge you in a certain way, and in a straight out way. When after Battlefield came down and flopped miserably, we were having a long conversation about where we should go next, and one of them sat up to me, a guy that I really respect, and said, "Look, Giles, I can't get you through Warner's doors for another 10 years."
Oh wow.
So, you know, the best thing you can do is go back to Europe, regroup, do some small budget films, and hope you can build your career up again. And so to have that at the beginning of your career where you just sort of almost stepped off, suddenly you're doing Indiana Jones, suddenly you're doing a few independent films like the films that I've done with Deep and Meta, which are out in India, which are social subjects, and then I do Star Wars, the next step I take, the result of that is somebody saying, you know, you came to Hollywood, you should go home. You know, it's basically this town isn't big enough for the two of us. And at that level, that's the point at which what we're just talking about is where your mettle is. You know, whether or not at that point you say, okay, I tried, I failed, or whether or not you go back and you regroup and try again, or whether you just battle on. And yeah. I think, you know, in that process, you have to overcome that. And I'm not saying that it was that easy to overcome that. I'm not saying that that doesn't, you know, the fact that it still comes up on my IMDb, it says best known for. These are things that everybody has to deal with. You know, and there are some great DPs out there that have to deal with other stuff that they don't want to see. And particularly in the world of the internet and the work, you know, everything's out there for everybody. These things aren't forgotten easily. But, you know, I say as a DP, you know, ultimately, I don't write the script. You know, I'm not the director. Pat Topolis, that was a designer of that, went straight on to do iRobot and then directed Underworld. You know, the system, you just have to be strong enough with the system to keep going. You know, because that always is the deal. And whatever you do in life, you know, if somebody sort of hits you across the face and you just back off and disappear, then, you know, there's not much of you left. And the answer is that you push ahead. You did regroup. And to finish that off, the nice side of that was that the guy that sat up and walked out, I actually respected him for it. And I said to myself, Hollywood is tough, you know. And then a year later, at 3 o'clock in the morning, I received a phone call because I just won the cinematography prize at Sundance for The Deep End. And
wow.
he phoned me up at 3 o'clock in the morning, and he said, "Hey, Giles, how are you doing? I haven't spoken to you for a year. You're back on," and put the phone down. and you know, it's a real sort of, it's a sort of Hollywood story, but it's true. You just have to, you know, that film was already in the pipeline. And in fact, I remember doing that film thinking, hold on, I'm on my way to greater things, because obviously Battlefield Earth hadn't come out there. You know, I just done a $60 million picture. Why am I doing this tiny little picture? You know, and actually, if anything, you know, that slap makes you more determined. It also makes you look at yourself, look at your, you know, what you're good at, what you're not good at, or where you're going to put yourself, and whether or not you want to take on this, you know, this whole system. I've never got the system out of my head. I'm one of these people that, you know, I'm sitting here in Hollywood at the moment, but, you know, I'm one of these people that always wants to make that system work, and that's because, you know, I always felt that with enough determination, you can take the whole system on and you can get to somewhere. We're not all Bob Richardsons. We're not all Chivos. You know, but on the other hand, there are a lot of good DPs that can actually get some great projects if they stay in long enough.
I really love your answer to that, and how you've expressed kind of what you went through in the aftermath of that. Because, and I don't think when the general public thinks of success or failure in terms of box office, I don't think they're sensitive at all to the intricacies of the creative process. And so they're working on two different planes. Obviously the studio heads and the creatives are just coming from different levels. But you know, that was your first collaboration with Scott and David right after Battlefield Earth. Was it The Deep End?
When we were shooting, Battlefield was released.
Okay.
And that was I have to say that we all went out there with a very good script. Two extremely, extremely tight directors, people that knew what they wanted, knew how they wanted to put it on film. There was a level of attention that I really, really loved about that film, and about the fact that we were all away, we were all shooting, and that I was working with everybody that was trying to work to the highest standard. And that to me, in a way, that was my first experience of shooting in the United States, that I was shooting with technicians that were non-union, that were probably considered not as good as the union guys, but their level of proficiency was extremely high. And I think there was something tied to the fact that we knew we were going to see this film. The film was going to be released. You know, it was distributed by Fox Searchlight. It was on scope, that we knew that we were in a real process of independent American filmmaking.
There's a film on your resume that I saw when it came out a few years ago, that I absolutely love, and I adore the look of it. It's the Loss of a Teardrop Diamond.
Yes.
And there's such a like sublime sense of place and candlelight. Tell me about crafting the look of that world in that film.
Yeah, I mean, I always regard myself as sort of a slightly practical technician as well as hopefully a creative DP. And Teardrop Diamond, we shot on Anamorph, we shot on scope. As you can see, most of it was night. The actors were not with us a huge amount of time because obviously there was a huge amount of costuming to be done, and we had to work within a 12-hour day. So we actually had the actors for a very small amount of time. So everything within Teardrop was relative to the fact that we had a Tennessee Williams script that was 135 pages long and 28 days to shoot it.
Wow.
And so it was always, and of course, because we were dealing with the Tennessee Williams script, the script was inviolate. So it was one of those things where there was such a huge amount of respect towards those words, and because we all felt the pressure of doing, you know, it's like doing Shakespeare, you know, it's doing the great man's words. I think we approached that probably in a much too reverential way. And my approach on the whole thing was, one was that I had to make sure that, allowing the limitation of the time that we had and the time with the actors, that we obviously had to get through the material, but that it stayed within a framework that was classic enough to represent, if you like, not necessarily just the 20s, but also the period that Tennessee Williams wrote in, and also modern enough that it wouldn't be extremely tedious for the audience. So there's a point where you look at that piece of work and you say it's a theatrical piece of work, so therefore should be a very proscenium art piece of work. I mean, we could have literally put on a wide shot and let those people be choreographed into movements, towards them and, you know, upstage and downstage. We could have approached it in that way. But I was one of the reasons why we did it on scope was that we really felt that it had to have a huge cinematic value. I mean, the other super important thing for me was that, you know, I wanted Bryce to look dazzling. Mm-hmm. I really wanted her to look dazzling. And it wasn't an easy thing. One, you know, Bryce had just had a baby. So she just slimmed down enough to be able to, she's supposed to be a tiny little thing in the actual screenplay. She just had a baby. It was 100 degrees out there, you know, with 110% humidity because we were shooting in the summer in Louisiana, and she was wearing a fur coat most of the time. So a lot of the trick there was to be able to work fast enough so that she could actually you know, not die because of the heat and the situation out there. But I did really, really want it to glow. And one of the things we did within a lot of the film actually happens within one house at a party. You know, I can't remember, 20 minutes of the film, 25 minutes of that film. And that was five night shooting out there. So we rigged the whole house with light boxes that I built with the key grip and backed everything, hiding them up in the ceiling, you know, backed everything back to cables, back to dimmers, so that basically everything was built into that lighting key fill and backlight for every single place where everybody moved. And we managed to do that and rig that during the, because we were shooting exteriors in daytime beforehand, then we rigged the interior while we were shooting that. But what that gave was that the whole film, for me, seemed extremely uniform in terms of its classic lighting. It doesn't mean it's hard lighting, but it just meant that it had a classic feel to it that actually followed from one room to the next. So that you weren't really dealing with a, you know, my idea was that allowing that it's a piece of theatre, and it is a piece of theatre, it was actually written for the screen, but it, obviously being a Tennessee Williams piece of work, it's written like a piece of theatre, that if you could feel that the whole thing was homogenous, if you could feel that it was just a flowing act, because that's what those 25 minutes are, is an act, then it would feel like you were in that party with them and you were in that period with them. And I think we did pretty well within the time we had to achieve that.
I think you did too. I mean, there's such a kind of I don't even know, there's a transcendent quality to that film, and I think a lot of it has to do with the imagery that you created for it. One of the running themes of the set of interviews that I've done for this third season of the cinematography series has been the looking at past films or photography to kind of inspire the current project you're working on, and yet not being a slave to those films. Do you run into that at all?
I think when everybody approaches, when a director sits down with the DP, I think all of us, you know, first of all, we all need references. All of us have access to a certain amount of cinematic history. Some have more, some have a different, you know, have a different view on the type of things that they were probably watching when they were a kid. And I think all of these things are references that we need to take in and either reject or adopt. The idea of emulating somebody else's work has obviously never been particularly interesting to me, as I'm sure it's not interesting to many other DPs.
So I've also been asking all of our cinematographers, if you were to teach a class on cinematography and you look throughout film history, what scenes or films would you pull from to teach various lessons to your students?
Well, I think we're all, you know, I mean, all of us that grew up, I remember, you know, I was 18 when Apocalypse Now came out.
Wow. Yeah.
So that was the first, it was literally, I was 18. That was the first time that, you know, I actually saw a movie, and I'd, you know, they sneaked me into Lolita before that, because it was one of the local film club where I lived in Newcastle, and I was with a lot of students, and they sneaked me into that, you know, just a short while. I was still 17, because that was an 18 as well, you know, an 18 rating. And then we went across to see, and this was in a way, this was even before I was working in the theatre at the time. I wasn't even, you know, even though I was very interested in cameras, I hadn't really made that mental transition. I certainly didn't have a job in filmmaking. So I wasn't approaching it from, you know, the fact that it was Storaro. We knew who Coppola was. We knew how good his filmmaking. We knew the history of Apocalypse Now. But I think that's one of the things that would, you know, it's one of the first things that you would actually show us, you know, a class. Because for the simple reason that it changes. You know, that within every, you know, within different sections of the film, you know, he does, you know, Storaro does go from points where he's using massively soft light or over, you know, clouded light or anything to, you know, the extremely dramatic hard light that he used towards the end of the film.
That's it for this episode of the Art of Cinematography series. You can hear more episodes in this series by visiting moviegeeksunited.net/Art of Cinematography.